Chapter 5. It Takes a Democrat. Let me suggest a different framework for understanding the Clinton years. Something even grander than the Clinton Wars, or NASDAQ, or even Bill's postpartisan journey to self-discovery. Here's what I propose. How the market order got cemented into place. It wasn't Ronald Reagan alone who did it. What distinguishes the political order we live under now is consensus on certain economic questions, and what made that consensus happen was the capitulation of the Democrats. Republicans could denounce big government all they wanted, but it took a Democrat to declare that the era of big government is over and to make it stick. This was Bill Clinton's historic achievement. Under his direction, as I wrote back then, the opposition ceased to oppose. The Secret History. For those who are interested in the economic well-being of average Americans and in the political system's failure to protect them, one of the most telling episodes of the Clinton years is something that went largely unreported at the time. The series of secret negotiations with House Speaker Newt Gingrich that Clinton held in 1997. Liberals saw the Republican Gingrich back then as Clinton's unappeasable nemesis, as a berserk hater. But in fact, the two men came from similar class and generational backgrounds and saw eye to eye on a number of things: NAFTA, deficit reduction, welfare reform, and the great overarching sophistries about change and the new economy. The object of Clinton's outreach to Gingrich in 1997 was Social Security privatization, a hunk of legislative dynamite that would have blown apart the welfare state once and for all. According to Stephen Gillen, the historian who uncovered this episode in his 2008 book, The Pact, privatization in some form had become attractive to politicians in both parties at that time. The word he uses to describe this growing attitude is consensus, as in the growing consensus on both sides of the aisle in favor of having Social Security tap into the stock market to increase the rate of return on retirement funds. Gillen doesn't spend much time describing the lobbying campaign mounted by the mutual fund industry in the late 90s to encourage Social Security privatization, a memorable effort driven by the brutally simple fact that requiring every American to have a brokerage account would have meant billions in administrative fees for mutual fund companies. But the historian does provide a fine account of the sensibility in the air in professional class circles in the late 90s. Describing the members of an advisory council on Social Security in 1996, Gillen writes that all agreed that the program needed to be reformed. All accepted that some portion of Social Security revenue should be placed in investments other than low-paying U.S. Treasury bonds. They agreed that benefits must be trimmed, that the retirement age should be pushed back, and that state and local government workers should be required to participate. All agreed. All accepted. It's difficult for outsiders to understand the kind of hypnotic appeal such invocations of consensus hold for Washington and the prosperous, well-educated fellows who inhabit it. Every one of them knows that the real problem with government is what they call entitlement spending, meaning Social Security and Medicare, that the obvious solution is some sort of privatization, and also that every other responsible, professional class person either agrees on this matter or else is a charlatan or demagogue of some species or other. I've heard some expression of this consensus since the day I met my first congressional staffer back in the 80s. I've heard it from certain kinds of Democrats as well as Republicans, from losers as well as winners. As with free trade and welfare reform, there is no amount of reporting or argument that will budge this idée fixe. People of a certain educational background simply know it to be true. Which brings us to the second thing that everyone agrees upon, that ideology merely gets in the way. That if educated people from both parties could just get together and put partisanship aside, some great understanding on this matter of entitlements could quickly be reached. This is the Holy Grail, the high-minded act of privatization that would terminate the New Deal's most popular achievement and bring to a close the era of activist government. This is the true grand bargain our leaders have chased from the 90s up to the age of Obama. In 1997, the deal evaded Bill Clinton's grasp, but only barely. According to Gillen, Clinton and Gingrich had come to an agreement on how private accounts would be incorporated into the Social Security system. In exchange, the Republicans would stop pushing to blow the federal surplus on a tax cut. Like the New Democrats in our story, Gingrich claimed this was the right thing to do because of change. We were trying to think through the necessary reforms to modernize America to move into the 21st century, he told the historian. The two leaders knew this would mean building a new center-right political coalition to get the deed done, because many Democrats could be counted on to oppose the deal. Indeed, as Gillen notes, on numerous issues, the president was closer to Gingrich than he was to the leadership of his own party, a description that could have been accurately applied to each of Clinton's great accomplishments, NAFTA, welfare reform, and bank deregulation, all of them made into law by cooperation between the Democratic president and the Republicans in Congress. The schedule on which the two men agreed went as follows. Clinton would start hinting at the privatization proposal in January 1998. Various groups would then spend the year conducting a Social Security dialogue, whose conclusions can be easily guessed. Incredibly, the two leaders would somehow contrive to keep the issue off the table in the 1998 congressional elections, and then get it enacted during the lame duck session in December 1998 when nobody could hold either of them responsible. Clinton actually went through with the first step in the plan, demanding in his 1998 State of the Union address that Congress use the federal surplus to save Social Security first. A vague but noble-sounding demand that appears to have been his way of opening the privatization discussion. As it happened, Social Security was already safe. Safe from Clinton, that is, thanks to a certain Oval Office dalliance. The week before his speech, the media frenzy over Monica Lewinsky had begun, and it was all polarization and impeachment after that. The day of the speech itself, Hillary Clinton went on TV and accused a vast right-wing conspiracy of coming together in an effort to bring her husband down. This was true enough as regards the sex scandal, but the conspiracy that really mattered was the one between her husband and his putative right-wing rival, Newt Gingrich. And here's why the D.C. pundits came to love Bill Clinton. He almost did it. He almost achieved that great coalescence of the business and professional classes. This was a Democrat, remember. And him being a Democrat was important. For the party that invented Social Security and defended it with a kind of gleeful zeal over the years, for this party even to contemplate turning the thing over to Wall Street was a concession of enormous significance. Captive Nation. A few years ago, I read an article claiming that the United States is the first society ever to record more rapes of men than of women, a distinction attributable to the vast numbers of men we have seen fit to imprison. Another disturbing fact. According to the legal scholar Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, there are now more black adults in some kind of correctional control, meaning under the restraint of some arm of the criminal justice system, than there were slaves in 1850. Naomi Murakawa, author of The First Civil Right, adds that fully one in three black men passes his life under probation, parole, or prison on any given day. Not only does the United States have the largest population of people incarcerated of any country, but we are the only nation that routinely hands out life sentences to children. Anyone inquiring how an obscenity like this came to pass, how it is that the home of the free outstripped what we used to call captive nations, as well as countries philosophically dedicated to wholesale imprisonment like apartheid South Africa, anyone looking into these things soon realizes that this can't be laid simply and neatly at the doorstep of the Republican Party and those awful wingers. It's true that the Republican Richard Nixon started the war on drugs, and that the Republican Ronald Reagan escalated it. But the Democrat Bill Clinton, the buddy of Bono and Nelson Mandela, the man repeatedly nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, easily bested both of these Republicans, as well as all other presidents, in his zeal to incarcerate. Michelle Alexander writes as follows of Clinton's 1994 crime law. Far from resisting the emergence of the new caste system, Clinton escalated the drug war beyond what conservatives had imagined possible a decade earlier. As the Justice Policy Institute has observed, the Clinton administration's tough-on-crime policies resulted in the largest increases in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history. If anything, Alexander is soft-pedaling this indictment. The big clampdown was a massive exercise in prison building and mandatory sentencing. Clinton himself went before the eyes of the nation to promote this great new tactic called three strikes, where triple offenders of certain kinds got to spend the rest of their lives in prison. His 1994 crime bill coerced state governments to enact what were called truth in sentencing provisions, which meant, essentially, a crackdown on parole. In 1995, as I mentioned before, Clinton signed his name to the bill stopping the U.S. Sentencing Commission from abolishing the notoriously racist 100-to-1 difference in penalties for crack and powdered cocaine. Not everything lousy that happened in the country in the 1990s was Bill Clinton's fault, but with criminal punishment as well as with Social Security and free trade, the say-so of the left party in the system completely changed the balance of the situation. It was as though every kind of cruelty was suddenly permitted. The nation descended into a punitive frenzy, with state legislatures inventing ways to lock up their citizens with a kind of demonic glee. The state of Virginia, under the leadership of Republican Governor George Allen, abolished parole altogether in 1995. Zero tolerance entered the lexicon, and universal surveillance became part of the urban environment. In 1994 and 95, numerous states passed their own three strikes laws, with truth in sentencing provisions trotting along behind, as encouraged by Bill Clinton's law. Historians of the Clinton presidency generally skip over the imprisonment craze into which he led the country in the mid-90s. It's hard to account for if the framework you're applying to those years is one in which Clinton was the victim of right-wing persecution. Those who do acknowledge Clinton's part in the big clampdown either depict it as a great success in the fight against crime, which it was not, or else describe it in superficial Washington terms. He got a great big law passed through Congress, thus proving he could be an effective bipartisan leader. Besides, in rhetorical terms, Bill Clinton has always been a steadfast opponent of mass incarceration. In 1991, he said he thought it was awful that we are now the number one nation in the world in the percentage of people we put in prison. In 1995, 2 weeks before he signed the crack cocaine law, he declared that blacks are right to think something is terribly wrong when there are more African-American men in our correction system than in our colleges, when almost 1 in 3 African-American men in their 20s are either in jail, on parole, or otherwise under the supervision of the criminal system. In an interview with Rolling Stone in 2000, Clinton said, "The disparities are unconscionable between crack and powdered cocaine. I tried to change that." In 2008, he said he was sorry for the crack cocaine law. And then, when every presidential candidate began talking up prison reform in 2015, he apologized again, this time saying that the 1994 crime bill was overdone, and thus implying that he hadn't really meant to throw so many people in prison. And maybe that's what really matters. Maybe that will suffice to get Clinton off the hook on the day when some future Truth and Reconciliation Commission finally starts parceling out the blame for the generation-destroying policies of those years. But I doubt it. Someday we will understand that the punitive hysteria of the mid-1990s was not an accident. It was essential to Clintonism, as essential as his vaunted repeal of the welfare system. Clinton treated different groups of Americans in radically different ways, crushing some in the iron fist of the state, just as others were getting bailouts, deregulation, and a frolicking celebration of think-different business innovation. And there's really no contradiction between these. Lenience and forgiveness and joyous creativity for one group, while the other gets a biblical-style beatdown. These things actually fit together quite nicely. Indeed, the ascendance of the first group requires that the second be lowered gradually into hell. When you take Clintonism all together, it makes sense, and the sense that it makes has to do with social class. Think of it as a slight variation on Stiglitz's observation about the superiority of speculation to all other occupations. What the poor get is discipline. What the professionals get is endless indulgence.